are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of University of Missouri, Karen Piper, on her book, The Price of Thirst, Global Water Inequality and the Coming Chaos. Also on the program today, President outlines a series of actions he will take and wants to see taken to deal with the issue of police abuse, including a request from Congress for funds for body cameras for cops around the country. Also on the program today, the heartwarming story of billions of dollars that went to pay for an Iraqi army that didn't exist. And then the equally heartwarming story about the failure of the international community to step up and spend a fraction of those billions of dollars on feeding refugees as a result of the Syrian conflict. Because if you can't pay for bombs, what's the point for paying for anything? Also on the program today, new polling suggests that, oddly enough, Latinos appreciate the fact that the president recognized their humanity and has no problem with immigrants who have been living in this country for years staying at least temporarily. And Jeb Bush almost announces that he's not going to run for president in 2016. And Joe Scarborough proves what once again just how successful you can get if you do not pay attention to any facts or willfully ignore them. And once again, the Senate and the House has stepped in front of President Obama's ability to close down Guantanamo Bay. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just an update on a story that we talked about yesterday. That GOP staffer, I couldn't help myself. We had said that we weren't going to do this, but I couldn't help myself. That GOP, that Republican staffer, she was a communications director for a Republican congressman, Representative Stephen Fincher, Republican, Tennessee. She was the one who posted on Facebook that she didn't really appreciate the way that Sasha and Malia, I mean, this is unbelievable, but I guess it's that time of year. She didn't appreciate the way that Sasha and Malia were dressing like they were going out to a bar instead of going to a turkey pardoning session at the White House. And she didn't appreciate how I understand you're teenagers, but show a little more respect Not so much eye rolling. Try showing a little class, I think,
I don't
is what
know
she.
What Islam
you got to press the button.
I don't know.
Okay, turn his mic down.
I don't know what Islam teaches your people about the turkey pardon, but here in America, in the US of A, we take it very seriously, Sasha Malaya.
So she was chastising them for acting like teenagers. And frankly, you know, if you look at the video, I don't see it. But frankly, I also don't care. But these girls need to be just told. Now, it's no wonder they don't respect it because their parents don't respect their positions either.
Just imagine y'all are walking into a mosque or, I don't know, like a Kevin Hart movie or something, and just pretend it's the same thing, for Lord's sake.
Well, she immediately apologized on Facebook. I don't know, immediately. Oh, I meant immediately as in after like 22,000 people commented or gave her a thumbs down or whatever it is on Facebook, suggesting that it was the most successful public relations campaign she's ever waged. And then she was offered her resignation, and it was accepted by the Republican congressman she worked for. Well, it turns out that part of that resignation might not have just been because of what she said, but the fact that she had been arrested when she was 17 for a misdemeanor larceny after she allegedly stole from a Belka department store in North Carolina. That's according to the Smoking Gun. And now I've seen pictures of her, you know, not exactly appropriate behavior for completely appropriate behavior for a teenager. It just so happens that if you're going to throw those type of sticks and stones, you better make sure that you do not live in an incredibly fragile, tenuous, single-paned glass house. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Karen Piper on her book, The Price of Thirst, Global Water Inequality, and the Coming Chaos. But before we do any of that, ladies and gentlemen, I got to tell you, Mila wants to buy me a Hanukkah present, and I was telling her, you know, basically, look, Mila, the bottom line is I would much rather you make something for me because that's what I love. And she's like, well, I am going to make something for you. She's going to make me another backup wallet out of duct tape. But she wants to buy me something. And amazingly enough, I actually have figured out what she can afford that I actually genuinely want. You've heard me talk about Harrys.com in the past. Harry's is that online shaving company, I guess you would call it, right? They sell razors and shaving utensils. And, well, that's what it is, right? I mean, it's you buy a razor. You also can get lotion. Yeah. And they sent me, when we started a campaign with them, they sent me one of the sets. I can't remember the name of the set, but it was awesome. You get three razors, you get some shaving cream, and the razors are actually seriously good. I always thought like a sharper razor was bad. Now, you know I don't shave that often, but when I shave now, I don't get those, I don't want to get gross about it, but those like ingrown hairs I used to get. That was ostensibly the reason why I didn't shave. And in reality, it's just I don't want to shave. But I always had to develop an excuse. But this is actually a genuinely good shave. And now Mila can actually afford to buy me this. We give her an allowance, a couple of bucks a week. And then she gets money for us when anybody swears around her. I don't end up paying her, but Nikki pays her a lot of money for that. You can get a winter Winston set. It's 30 bucks for a chrome razor, three high-quality blades, and the foaming shave gel or shaving cream, whichever one you like better. It's already wrapped. The shipping is free. You can use the coupon code MajorityReportHoliday. You get $5 off your first purchase. So if you go with the basic kit, which I used before, which frankly I think is awesome, I'm going to see if I can upsell Myla to the Winter Winston set. But you'll get the razor, three blades, and a tube of the foaming and a tube of the foaming gel for just $10. How would you not do this at this point? Or at least tell your kid to do it for you. So check it out. It's harrys.com. The promo code is Majority Report Holiday. And you should also know that Harry's donates 1% of their sales and volunteer 1% of all their employees' time with their community partner called City Year. So check it out. Go to harrys.com. Enter the coupon code Majority Report Holiday at the checkout. You get $5 off. You're going to love their razors. You're going to love the convenience and the fact that you don't have to deal with those like absurd fortresses of plastic that they put these razors in today. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Karen Piper. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of English and Geography from the University of Missouri, author of The Price of Thirst, Global Water Inequality and the Coming Chaos, Karen Piper. Welcome to the program, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's jump right in. One of the first things that, and this is more of a sort of a general question about water, although it's come up in the context of Detroit recently. But I didn't realize that it wasn't until 2010 that the UN, and it's almost bizarre that the UN has to do this, said that water was a basic human right.
Yeah, and that was after decades of struggle by what are called water justice activists around the world to make that happen. So it was an important moment, and now people can sue for those rights and refer to the UN law regarding this or the UN resolution regarding this. So hopefully it will help people who go without water and who are being cut off all over the world because they can't pay for water.
And so this becomes more and more relevant because, I mean, what were the factors that made it take so long?
Initially, it was interesting to watch because I sort of watched the water as a human right issue for the past decade. And initially, it was the activists who were supporting it and the corporate world that were opposed to it. And they, you know, the corporate world didn't want it to be some sort of water socialism. Hello?
Yep.
Hello? Oh, there's some sound going on there.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear us? Are you having any problems now?
Is it a commercial?
No, I don't know what it is. Are you hearing anything now? Hello?
I'm hearing a commercial.
Oh, gosh.
Are you hearing it?
No.
Oh, sorry. That's really strange.
It is strange.
I can just try to talk through it. Oh, there, it's gone. No?
We're trying to figure out what's going on our end.
Yes. It's gone now. I can keep talking.
All right. Yeah. So go ahead. So initially it was the activists and the
corporations were opposed to it because they were afraid of some kind of water socialism where they wouldn't be able to charge enough money for water. But then over time, the water corporations jumped on the bandwagon of supporting water as a human right, because I think for them that meant that they could now require governments to pay subsidies for people to then pay to the corporations so that they would be able to get a certain amount of water.
Ah, I see. And so that's a little bit so they basically are looking for this is a way for corporations to sort of ensure that they have a constant demand in some ways.
Yeah, so it's been interesting to watch because now they're saying, oh, we supported water as a human right all along. We, you know, basically started the whole movement. And I know that's not true. So it's interesting.
And was there a marked difference in how much sort of corporate control? I mean, what was the pivot point for corporations in that argument? In other words, did they at that point have a certain percentage or at least a precedent set that that water could be privatized as such so that they would be this right all of a sudden would mean that governments were almost required to buy water from them?
Well, I think it was over time a set of circumstances occurred that made this happen. One of those circumstances was in Johannesburg. Initially, Suez was in Johannesburg and was cutting off people's water left and right when they weren't paying. And these are like poor people living in shanty towns where they would install water piping and then turn it off the second someone couldn't pay, including not paying for their apartheid era debts. They wanted them to pay all the debts from that time period. And so what happened is people then started going to rivers and drinking. And there were big cholera outbreaks in South Africa that started to scare people. And so a law was passed saying that people had to have a certain amount of water per person per day, which isn't much at all. It's like less than one toilet flush of water. But the government then began to subsidize that. And so I think around that time, the corporate world realized, oh, well, the government will subsidize it. We don't have to give away free water. So it became, in a way, another source of income for them.
And we should
guaranteed income,
right?
From poorer people. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in Detroit because they're cutting off water left and right up in Detroit. And so I never thought that that would happen in the U.S. to the extent that it is, but it's because Detroit is gearing up to privatize its water supply. And so I'm wondering what will happen there.
I want to get to more of your book, but explain to people that dynamic, because we do have a situation. It seems the last I followed was that the bankruptcy attorney said yes. The bankruptcy judge acknowledged that it was a human right by the UN, but then said, "But in this case, it doesn't apply." Essentially, why would the city be increasing rates and cutting off customers as a way of privatizing, as on the road to privatization?
Because in order to even attract a private water company, they have to show that they have paying customers. And so if it looks like the city is just giving away water for free, that's not going to be attractive to a corporation. So they want like the highest paying customers getting the most water. Does that make sense?
Yes. So
it's like, you know, it's cut off those that don't pay so that you don't have those, you know, debts on your books. I mean, it's all just seeing water as money, basically.
It's interesting this dynamic with water as a human right, and then the corporations supporting that has the same sort of dynamic as, in some ways, the Affordable Care Act, insofar as everybody should be insured. And so the private health insurance companies are excited about that because they're the mechanism in which that's going to happen, and they're going to get subsidized by the government.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
And so let's talk about this as because there's multiple reasons, right, why we have water shortages. Some of those are a function of nature or are abuse of nature, and then they're compounded by neoliberal, I'm putting this in air quotes, solutions. So let's start with the three main drivers of water scarcity, or maybe let's start with the notion of water scarcity. How much of a problem are we going to have with water?
Big problems. And I always say water scarcity is a misnomer of sorts, because we always have the same amount of fresh water available in the world. Water just recycles itself in this great water cycle. It goes from rain to streams to ocean to rain again. But the problem is the amount of clean water is shrinking. And so there's three main reasons for water shortages. One is pollution, one is climate change, and one is groundwater loss, so groundwater overextraction. And we're being hit by all three pretty hard right now. In terms of pollution, what's interesting is that the corporate world sees this as a boon, because the more water is polluted, the more it's costly to treat it, and then the more they can charge consumers for treating it, and the more we need them to treat it. In terms of climate change is basically, I see it as like a big machine for moving water around and for creating salt water, basically. So you take our freshwater banks or our glaciers. As they melt, they go straight out to the ocean. And so you have less fresh water and you have more salt water. And so and climate change makes where water will be located very unpredictable. It's going to be moving. And the problem with our water infrastructure is that it's not transportable. So, you know, for instance, you might have the same amount of water, but now it might be in Canada instead of Los Angeles, and you can't just pick up all of LA and move to Canada. So that's a big problem, is the mobility of water. And then groundwater overextraction. We're just pumping our fossil aquifers way too fast. And a fossil aquifer is water underground that's taken thousands of years to become stored there. So it's like a giant underground reservoir that we're draining, and we can't wait thousands of years for it to come back. And so one of those fossil aquifers is in the Great Plains in the United States, the Ogallala Aquifer. And we've, we had a great dust bowl there before in the 1930s, which we only stopped through irrigation and pumping groundwater. But now when we have another great dust bowl there, we're not going to have water to pump over it anymore to fix it. So all of these things are just affecting the availability of water to us.
Well, what is this? What happens in these situations? I mean, you know, California is going through, obviously, an extended drought. In Rio, I just saw a report, I think it was just 2 or 3 days ago, that in Sao Paulo, I should say, that they have now moved on to like their third reserve, and the only thing they have left is to basically extract if it doesn't rain more, because they keep apparently waiting for it to rain. If it doesn't rain more, they actually have to extract the water now from mud, which of course is very expensive.
Oh no, yeah. Yeah, that's the problem. It's what are you going to do with these huge populations when that water disappears? In India right now, they've overpumped their groundwater so much that there's fluoride concentrated in the groundwater that is now becoming a source of mass poisoning in India that they're starting to worry about, because all the water is pumped too much, and so it's all polluted with fluoride.
And so, wait. So, how does that work? So, the fluoride and the other, I guess, maybe either natural or non-natural chemicals.
Yeah, it's natural, but it sits at the bottom of the aquifer. And so, when they pump it out, they get to the bottom and they start pumping out this high density fluoride water.
And so, all right. So, in your book, I mean, you look at where water or the lack of water has either created crises in terms of social conflict, or has led to sort of policies that have increased water inequity. Let's talk about California in that sense, because I had no idea about this water banking. Tell us about what's going on in California.
Water banking is the idea of just storing water underground by letting it basically percolate in the ground. You just flood the area and let it percolate down, and then you store it underground until you pump it up to sell to the highest bidder. So it's, you know, deposits in and deposits out, they kind of say. And so right now the main water holders there are agribusiness. And so in 1994, they demanded that one of these aquifers that was actually, or one of these banks that was actually created to protect California from drought, they demanded that it be handed over to them as a private holding, because they said, well, we hold the water rights for this. And so now they're storing water underground in California to sell to people who can afford their prices. And it's incredibly ironic, because that one of their biggest buyers is actually the state. They're getting water subsidized to grow crops, but then rather than growing those crops, they're storing it and they're selling it back to the state at 10 times the amount in order to remediate environmental problems that are created by lack of water.
That is a stunning.
So they're calling it like classic arbitrage. You know, it's like they're getting it at low cost from one buyer and then selling it at high cost to another buyer. But in this case, or one seller and then selling it to another buyer. But in this case, it's the same entity.
Right. This is just almost the same model that the banks use, right?
Exactly.
When they're getting
yeah.
the bailouts from the U.S. government, and they turn around, they buy U.S.
Yes.
loans.
Exactly. It's crazy. So anyway, this is very successful, because they're making a lot of money from it. And so these banks are now popping up all over the Central Valley. And what's interesting then is like, well, who then is the highest bidder? Who are we going to sell this water to? And you'd think they'd just sell it over into the next valley to LA. But in reality, it's actually cheaper for them to build their own cities and sell water to these private cities, which is what they're talking about doing now. And many of them have started building these private cities in the Central Valley rather than transport it.
So wait, so these are banks, or they're the agribusiness?
They're agribusiness. They're agribusiness. Like Palm Wonderful is one of them.
And they're building basically communities, or, I mean, are they getting charters?
Yeah, they're
for these
gated
things?
Private towns. And so they'll have their own fire service, police, security force, everything. And they're complete. It's getting to be a trend all over the world for the super wealthy, who can then have services they can rely on, private services, while the rest of the world is not so certain.
And it's all just basically built around the fact that they have this increasingly valuable and obviously hugely necessary asset, water.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it gets even crazier than that, because they actually got this water from the state that it doesn't even exist yet. So they're holding water rights where there's no actual water. It's all based on the idea that one day the state will get more water from Northern California through a peripheral canal, and when that water comes, that these businesses will then have the right to it. So they're calling it paper water, and they're building these ghost cities out of paper water, basically. And then they're going to say, well, we have the rights to this water, we have the town, we need the water now.
And so wait a second. So has the state in any way tried to fight this? I mean, you know, I would imagine that the water rights that the agribusinesses had was a function of the fact that they were agribusiness as opposed to arbitrage
yes.
business.
Yes. yes and no. I mean, the state is really in bed with agriculture in California, with agribusiness. These are the richest people in the state. And so, and not only the state, like the Tea Party movement was based, had a very strong base in the Central Valley and was funded by these ag business people. So, you know, they've got a lot of power, and it's hard to fight them. And they've held these water rights for a long, long time. And so, yes, the state does try to fight them, and then they lose or they make a compromise.
So how much of the – when we read about, like, you know, these droughts out there, and that there's – that, you know, a lot of these metropolitan areas in California are in danger of having no water, is it – how much of it is a function of – we're going through a drought, and how much of it is a function that, to the extent that they're going through a drought, it is exacerbated by the fact that there are people hoarding water, essentially.
The thing is, you can't really separate the two because they're both happening. I mean, in California now, you have the Sierra snowpack isn't what it used to be, and that's where California gets most of its water. And it's decreasing because of climate change. And so you have less water available, and underground water resources have been pumped forever. And so that's disappearing. In Los Angeles, they're having problems with saltwater intrusion into the groundwater. So they're having a loss of water. They're also having a lot of environmental catastrophes occurring because of how they've handled water in the past that have to be remediated and are very expensive, like the Owens Lake, Los Angeles drained Owens Lake, and now creates this toxic dust storm that they have to water the lake with sprinklers just to keep the dust down. It costs billions of dollars. So there's things like that going on, a lot of environmental disasters. And then, so I guess I would say it's been an unsustainable use of water over the past century that is kind of doing California in. And one of the ways it's been unsustainable is we all know urban growth, of course, in LA, people think of that. But the bigger culprit is agriculture, because agriculture actually throughout the world uses 70% of our water supply. And the way we've done agriculture is incredibly wasteful. And so now some farmers are realizing, well, there's more money to be made from building more cities instead of growing things, and they're transforming their water to that use. But it's not like that's helping the situation.
So, I mean, and I want to touch on, you know, what you've written about Chile as well. But what is the answer then? I mean, is there, and maybe that's putting the cart before the horse, et cetera, or vice versa. But, I mean, what is the answer if it is if it's not just that we have the wrong solutions, what is the answer to this? Or is it just going to be, or is there no answer?
No, there is. The answer is sustainability. You know, it's rethinking the way that we develop, that we grow. And so, for instance, with agriculture, we need to do, if we did agriculture differently, that would be a huge solution. So what we need is organic agriculture, which uses less water. We don't need these monoculture massive farms, which are not only are they super thirsty. I mean, they use way too much water, but they also pollute water. They're one of the major polluters through pesticides and herbicides. And so if you get back to more organic agriculture, you save water and you also don't pollute water. And also things like permaculture, which is, it means permanent agriculture, where you can grow wheat now without ever having to plow the soil. And it tastes, I mean, I've had it in Kansas, they're growing it, and it makes this wonderful bread. And if you did that, you would just save so much water, preserve the environment. And ultimately what has to be stopped is climate change. So it's shifting the way we think about ourselves, really, and not like wasting as much water and electricity. But I don't mean, people tend to think on like an individual level, oh, I better turn off the lights, but I don't mean that. I mean, through government regulations, we need to change the way we do things in the country overall or in the world overall.
I want to get back to that because it's a sort of a classic battle between I think on some level, because there's so many other solutions or what appear to be solutions that are profit making for large corporations, that's going to be a very tough fight. But I do want to. I was really fascinated.
Exactly, that's the real problem.
I was fascinated by the implications of some of these water battles, and or I guess the social unrest that comes from this. And I know that you have contemplated the notion of ISIS in the context of water. Explain that to us.
Well, that occurred to me when I was in, first of all, in Iraq. And when I was in Iraq in 2008, people were complaining that their water was being cut off by Turkey. And then I went over to, I was in the whole area that's now in chaos because of ISIS on the border of Syria and Iraq. But then I went to Turkey, to the other side, and indeed there's these enormous dams that are being built called the Greater Anatolia Project that are cutting off the water supplies of Turkey, of Iraq and Syria. And at the time, I said to a Turkish water minister that, you know, you can't do this without expecting some kind of pushback. And he was very, you know, offended by the question and said, well, the water's ours. The oil's there, and the oil is theirs, and the water's ours. We can do whatever we want to with it. And so then, sure enough, ISIS pops up a few years later, and I was watching the news, and I saw ISIS, leaders of ISIS, talking about, this was on Vice News, talking about how one of their goals was to control the Euphrates River or regain control of the Euphrates River. And I noticed that they're starting, you know, they're targeting dams, they're trying to take over dams and get those water control back. And they said, you know, if we have to go to Istanbul to, you know, blow it up in order to get this water back, we will. And I thought, oh man, then I went ding, ding, now I get it. It's like ISIS is involved in all of this.
And I mean, in some respects, and certainly a huge portion of the bombing that we did initially against ISIS was in and around the Mosul Dam, which they were going to use as like a bomb on some level.
And Mosul's like a very precarious, not very well built dam to begin with. It's always been somewhat on the verge of collapse, and so the U.S. was worried about it when we were invading Iraq, about it, you know, falling apart then. But so it's a complicated situation because the U.S., of course, when we went in during the first Gulf War, we bombed all the electric utilities and cut off the water supply to most of the country. And so it's not like, you know, the U.S. has really helped the situation there either, obviously. I mean, they still don't have adequate water supplies after how many decades later.
And so how much of, when we talk about this sort of the impending chaos that you, or the coming chaos, as you call it, in the subtitle of your book, I mean, how much of it is, and how much do we have to separate out the notion of, you know, the sort of eternal aspect of people trying to control water as a resource in the same way they would like oil or, you know, whatever access to the sea, you know, as a as a commodity, or I should say a resource that nations fight over, and versus the sort of this incursion of corporate interests and you know, sort of. Because this is a great cycle.
How is it different?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great cycle they have, right? We pollute the water, and then which is basically are getting subsidized by the rest of society, and then you pay us again, and we fix it. I mean, that's the classic neoliberal cycle, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that one of the differences is that I've noticed from other privatizations or neoliberal deregulations is the desperation of people without water. You don't see the same thing with people who don't have electricity or oil. But it was when water started to be cut off, there's a symbolism around water that's so important that other resources don't carry. And so the big motto of the water activists is water is life. And for them, it's inseparable. You know, without water, you die. And there's something that's just so wrong about corporations coming in and saying, no, water is money. And so that's why the battle got to be so pitched between the water justice activists and the corporate world, because when they were fighting for water as a human right, the corporate world was saying, no, water is an economic good. And so the two views were very incompatible. And I think, you know, the reason I say like coming chaos is because of that kind of desperation that comes from people who don't have clean water to drink.
Interesting. And in terms of, I mean, what is the likelihood here when we are talking about those type of, there's so much money to be made in the business of cornering the water market, of both, again, that cycle, virtuous, not so virtuous cycle, I guess, of polluting the water and then cleaning it. I also imagine there are companies out there saying like, hey, we can desalinate. There's all sorts of things we can recycle wastewater.
I
mean,
it, yeah.
There's so much money, it seems. I mean,
sorry, I cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Even with climate change, it's so cynical. Hydropower companies are seeing it as a boon for them because with climate change, the glaciers are melting. So they're saying, oh, well, we have to build dams to capture all that glacial water before it disappears. So, you know, the idea of damming every glacier in the world is it's just making money off of climate change. Of course, it's ridiculous because they can't even build dams that would be able to withstand the kind of runoff from these glaciers that's occurring. But yeah, people see money everywhere and they go for it wherever they can. And change, you know, crisis and change is what creates opportunities for them.
And so what's the next thing that we're going to see? Or is it just simply going to be more of the same? We're going to continue to see more social unrest, more problems in various parts of the world as a function of diminished clean water supplies.
Yeah, more migration because there's parts in Africa, northern Africa, that are really drying up right now, and people who lived in marginal lands are being forced to move, and so they're moving to urban areas. So you're going to see a lot more, growth of these megacities, which are already disasters, and governments don't know what to do about them because they can't supply water to everybody. But so, yeah, you're going to see more desperation in how people migrate, more social unrest as people don't know quite what to do. And in the U.S., you know, we're somewhat protected here, unless, of course, unless you live in Detroit and are having water cut off. But even in the U.S., we're going to see water rates going up as water is privatizing all over the U.S. without people really noticing it. And, it happens slowly. And so, but those are the things to watch for. Basically, there's more inequity around water supplies around the world right now.
Karen Piper, author of The Price of Thirst, Global Water Inequality and the Coming Chaos. Thanks so much for your time today. We will link to the book at majority.fm. Really appreciate your telling
Thanks
us
a lot.
About it.
Appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the funner half. The number is 646-257-3920. Folks, we need your support. You can become a member of the Majority Report today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon for the holidays or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is you buy it actually for. Maybe you'll send Matt a whole box of cough medicine. You can go to our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap from there. We get a little bit of a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. That's also a great gift. You want to IM the show? Pick up the app. It's free. MajorityApp.com. iOS and Android. Or you can use your old-fashioned AIM or whatever it is and reach us at Majority FM. Or you can just do it one press of a button by getting the Majority app at majorityapp.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.